From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The defeat of ISIS. Not if, but when. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point. This week, the Pentagon gave President Trump its best-laid plans to accomplish his campaign promise to accelerate the crushing of ISIS. The Obama administration already had ISIS on the run, and destruction of the so-called caliphate is thought to be inevitable. What would it cost the U.S. to speed up the process? Arming the Kurds could mean trouble with Turkey. Syria's civil war might continue. U.S. casualties might not be acceptable to the American public. We'll find out what options the president is likely to be considering and the consequences of going too far too fast for political reasons. Later on today's Talking Point, Trumpism. In the Netherlands? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Trump campaigned on a promise to speed up the crushing of the so-called Islamic State. This week, the Pentagon provided a framework of options. We'll hear the pros and cons. On today's Talking Point later, in one of Europe's most liberal countries, a candidate for prime minister is hoping to follow in the footsteps of Donald Trump. We'll hear about the reclusive Geert Wilders and his one-man political party in the Netherlands. First, this news update, swimmer Michael Phelps, America's multiple Olympic gold medal winner, testified before Congress today. He said he's reluctant to voice his opinions, but that he feels the need to speak out about the testing and regulating of doping.
I can't describe how frustrating it is to see other athletes break through performance barriers in unrealistic timeframes, knowing what I had to do to go through that. All athletes must be held to the same standards, which need to be implemented and enforced with consistency and independence.
Alan Abrahamson is founding writer of Three Wire Sports. He covers the Olympics and the culture of sports. Alan, good to have you back on our program.
Hello, Warren.
There were others testifying before Congress today as well, including Travis Tigert, who is the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency CEO. What does Congress have to do with this?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay. So what were they doing there then?
Well, they were putting on a show that rhymes with the word hit that I can't say on the radio.
So obviously you have a low opinion of what's going on, but Congress certainly wants to take up the issue. It's so highly publicized, particularly when the Russians have been found to be doping their athletes on a widespread basis. So why shouldn't federal lawmakers be involved?
Well, that's a reasonable question. So let me put it back to you this way. There are 206 National Olympic Committees. Why shouldn't they all hold hearings? Who is the United States Congress to think that they should be holding hearings into why the Russians may or may not be doping? Over the weekend, the World Anti-Doping Agency and the International Olympic Committee said, oh, hey, yeah, there was institutional control in Russia, but we don't have evidence to pin anything on any specific Russian. I thought that the idea of individual justice was pretty fundamental to the American way. Did anybody in Congress mention that today? Here's the bottom line, Warren. This is an issue of money. Here's one thing I've learned after being married to my wife for 25 years. You know, not like everything can be solved by throwing money at it, but a great many things can be solved by throwing money at problems. The World Anti-Doping Agency's budget is $29.7 million. The United States government contributes $2.155 million toward that budget. That's roughly 7%. So the United States government's annual budget is, you know, let's say in the neighborhood of $3 trillion. So I'm a sports writer. I didn't major in math, but $2 million over $3 trillion amounts to basically nothing. So if they want to get serious about the anti-doping issue, let's throw some real money at this problem, and then let's reconvene.
What does that mean, or what do you mean by that? Where would the money go? And isn't it worth being concerned that some athletes are doped, as we heard Michael Phelps testify, and others aren't?
Of course that's worth concern. I make my living writing about doping in part. But the real question to Michael, with whom I wrote a New York Times bestseller, is, Michael, how many medals have you lost to a Russian swimmer? And the answer is zero. How much money does it take? I don't know. But I do know this. The annual budget at Ohio State is in the neighborhood of $150 to $200 million. The annual budget at Texas A&M and Oregon is $190 to $200 million. Let's at least get up there, and then we can start having a reasonable conversation. $29.7 million is chump change, Warren. That is chump change. And the United States government, let's be really, really clear about this. The reports that have caused all this concern, all this worry, two from the Canadian lawyer Richard Pound, two from the Canadian law professor Richard McLaren, in total, those four reports cost $3.7 million. That's outside of the $29.7 million. How much money did the United States government contribute to either of those four reports? The answer is not one penny.
So you're saying then that the U.S. isn't doing anything about doping. Could it do something about it if it wanted to, particularly when we had Mr. Tigert, head of the U.S. anti-doping agency today, saying that more than 1,900 high-risk athletes weren't even tested before the Rio Olympics?
I understand Mr. Tigert's well-taken concern that 1,900 athletes were not tested. That is a flaw in the system. However, it is a mistaken assumption to believe that tests and tests alone are the answer to this system. Let me remind one and all that Lance Armstrong boasted that he had taken and passed 500 tests. Similarly, Marion Jones boasted that she had taken and passed well over 100 tests. Yes, it's a problem that 1,900 people did not get tested. But tests alone do not offer the reassurance that the general public believes that they do or should. That is the reality.
Okay. Lance Armstrong, of course, the American cyclist. Marion Jones, the American sprinter. So we'll see what Congress does with this, if anything. Alan Abrahamson, again, the founding writer of Three Wire Sports. Always good to have you on our program.
A pleasure.
In a moment, the defeat of ISIS, not if, but when, on To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Trump wants to make good on a promise he repeated again and again on the campaign trail and after he won the election.
We want a strong military, and we don't want to have to use it. Ideally, we don't have to use it, although we will destroy ISIS.
This week, at the president's request, the Defense Secretary James Mattis gave the White House a set of options for dealing with ISIS. Gordon Leubold reports for the Wall Street Journal. And Gordon, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
What do you think that the Defense Secretary suggested to the new president?
Well, I think a range of different options. I think there's some recognition, by the way, that the president's dealing with a lot of other stuff domestically and otherwise. So I think their recommendations are probably fairly pointed. But they run the range from, you know, probably increasing in small numbers the troop presence in Iraq and Syria, probably loosening some of the restrictions that now govern kind of the amount of exposure those troops have to combat. There's also another issue of delegating lower down the authority to commanders to make battlefield decisions that had been retained in many ways by the Obama White House and his Pentagon. And there's, you know, kind of a wider range pertaining maybe to more exposure to civilian casualties potentially, which is already was done about 18 months ago, loosening that standard a little bit so that they could accelerate and have more airstrikes as needed. Still, of course, trying to prevent civilian casualties, but maybe loosening the restriction there. Those are the kinds of things. But I think generally the idea is that these are tweaks and not overhauls.
Tweaks of what the Obama administration has been doing?
That's correct. I mean, I think, you know, a change in strategy would be the Trump administration is going to send tens of thousands of troops into Iraq or Syria to do this. That's, you know, extremely unlikely to happen. This current strategy, which relies on indigenous forces to fight Islamic State, and we're primarily talking about Iraq and Syria here, even though ISIS exists like in Libya and Afghanistan and other places. That strategy of relying on indigenous forces to carry in the water is not likely to change. So that's what I mean by the tweaks.
And by indigenous forces, do we include the Kurds?
Well, that's one of the central questions, I think, when it comes to Syria and the stronghold of Raqqa that the Trump administration will have to confront is, does the U.S. Directly arm the Kurdish fighters, the YPG, who are known for being very effective fighters in northern Syria, but arming them has long concerned Turkey, and so the Obama administration kind of kicked that can into the new administration for them to decide. A lot of us heard Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, say the other day that speaking broadly about how to decide and how to think about some of these issues they're going to confront, you know, we don't want to make a decision that has a kind of a short-term gain and a long-term loss. And, you know, if I'm reading between the lines of something like that, I think that what he's saying is like, you know, if we arm the Kurds, we potentially do, you know, significant damage to the U.S.-Turkey relationship, which they don't want to do.
Do you think that General Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was suggesting that the president may have promised too much by suggesting that he could speed up this process?
Well, I think there's definitely a little bit to that. There are things that the military had, you know, kind of privately expressed frustration about as Obama was still in office about, say, as I alluded to before, like kind of getting approval for an airstrike, which could take weeks or months to get under the Obama administration because Susan Rice at the NSC and the president wanted more control of those kinds of decisions, depending on the kind of operation. They would like to see, and they already have seen, some delegation of authority further lower down in the chain of command just to kind of speed it up. And if you added more forces to Iraq or Syria, you know, you could potentially make the efforts there that much stronger. But there's not a magic bullet that's going to suddenly make ISIS disappear quickly.
Gordon Leubold with The Wall Street Journal. Andrew Exum is a research fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East Policy during the Obama administration. He also saw duty and tours as an Army officer in Baghdad and Fallujah. Andrew Exum, welcome to our program. Good to have you.
Hey, thanks, Warren. Appreciate it.
Do you think that the president is, in fact, being asked to speed things up in a way that might lead to the kinds of problems we just heard described by Gordon Leubold?
Yeah, I think Gordon nailed it pretty well, actually, and that most of the types of things that the president's going to receive from the military are going to be tweaks along the margins of a plan that the military, from its perspective, thinks is working. The key questions and the key decisions that we left for this administration really had to do with how much risk they want to assume in getting to Raqqa. There are two main cities that the Islamic State still controls, Mosul and Iraq, and we can see the pathway towards Mosul falling, and then Raqqa in Syria. If you want to get to Raqqa within the next 4 months, and this is a good assumption, and your assumption is still that you want to work by, with, and through local forces. In other words, you don't want to work, send the 82nd Airborne on the ground to go to Raqqa. Then you're going to need to provide more assistance, more equipment, and more training to the Kurdish forces. These Kurdish forces have ties to the PKK, which we recognize as a terrorist organization against which the Turkish state had we've been fighting for decades. So you can give these types you can give these Kurdish fighters more weapons, but the president's got to sign off on it as being in the national interest, and that's going to cause problems with Turkey.
The president again has promised that he would destroy ISIS. You have written in the Atlantic magazine that Donald Trump will defeat ISIS. What did you mean? And are we talking then about whether it happens sooner or later?
Yeah, I think that what's important here is that, first off, the threat from the terrorists of the Islamic State is not going to go away. We can see them, you know, morph into a terror threat. Second, the fighting in Syria and in places in Iraq is not going to end anytime soon. But the reality of the Islamic State will likely go away. And I think certainly by the next midterms, President Trump will be able to point towards a strategy largely designed and executed by his predecessor that has led to the fall of Mosul in Iraq and led to the fall of Raqqa and perhaps Deir ez-Zor in Syria and has led to what in essence will be the elimination of the Islamic State. So that's going to be something that President Trump will be able to crow about going into the 2018 midterms and his own reelection. And so he will be able to say that he delivered on this. What he's not going to get is he's not going to get, you know, that moment where you get a sign a surrender document across the, on the decks of the USS Missouri in Tokyo. You're not going to get that final decisive moment where you have victory. And I think, quite frankly, I think the president honestly thinks that that's the way that this war is going to end, and that the military's been held back for 15 years, and that if we only, you know, give them what they need, then they can do that. But the reality is that these wars are messy, and that we're likely to see not only the terror threat posed by the Islamic State and its whoever its successors are, but also the instability in Iraq and Syria continue for some time.
Nonetheless, can the president, Mr. Trump, be able to claim that he was responsible if, in fact, the Islamic State disappears? Or is it a result, as Gordon Lubold suggested earlier, of what the Obama administration's already done?
Well, victory is going to have 1,000 fathers, and the loudest of which will be this president. And so I think, yes, he will be able to claim that he has had success. Of course, the vast majority of the credit, if we're being fair, should go to the Iraqis themselves, who have fought like lions, quite frankly, and to win back Ramadi, Fallujah, Mosul, after getting their noses bloodied by the Islamic State, you know, on into 2015. And, of course, by the Syrians, who have fought against the Islamic State in Syria. You know, if we're working and fighting this campaign by, within, through our local partners, it's our local partners who should deserve the credit. But of course, the campaign coalition military campaign plan was designed by the U.S. military under the supervision of the Obama administration. It has involved over 40 different nations, including several other troop contributors beyond the United States. So there's going to be a lot of credit to go around when the Islamic State falls. But I think it's also fair to say that this president will crow about the role that he played, and will certainly, like any good politician, will claim that it was his decisive interventions that were the decisive act that led to the collapse of the Islamic State.
All right. Andrew Exum, again, a research fellow now at the Center for New American Security, but also Assistant Secretary of Defense, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Obama administration. Stephen Biddle is with us. He's a political science professor at George Washington University. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he also spent some time as a PhD, a part of a PhD team in Baghdad, helping to write the plan for the famous surge of General Petraeus. And on that team was General McMaster, H.R. McMaster, now the president's national affairs, national security advisor. And Stephen Biddle, thank you for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
What we've heard, it seems to me, is that it would be possible for the Trump administration to go too far too fast, if it were, and as it were, get into some trouble, or maybe send too many American troops, offend American civilians, maybe get in trouble with the Turks and so on. Do you think General McMaster is in a position to prevent that from happening?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, he doesn't make policy. He coordinates the interagency process. He makes recommendations to the president. He's not in the chain of command, and he doesn't issue orders for the conduct of this campaign. I am hopeful that he'll be a voice for clear analysis and reason. But at the end of the day, he's a voice. He's not the critical decision maker.
Do you agree that ISIS will be defeated, or at least that the Islamic State will disappear during the term of President Trump?
I think it's almost certainly the case that Raqqa will fall in the next couple of years. And what this whole debate is about, then, is when do you want it to fall, not whether, and what happens afterwards, and do we care about that? Regardless of which of the various options that are on the table now and that have been on the table for years for dealing with the Islamic State, we are probably not going to be looking at an Islamic State caliphate across the entire Mideast in 2030. They've been losing ground under the campaign as it's already being waged. Their governing model is non-viable. Their economic base is collapsing underneath them. What we're really talking about is the timing of an event that's very likely to occur anyway, and then whether what comes after that is a significant improvement or not.
We heard from Andrew Exum. He believes that President Trump thinks we're going to see a surrender at the table and that it's all going to be over. You've emphasized, as did he, what happens after. How likely do you think a nice, neat termination to all of this is possible? And if that's not in the cards, what is?
I think a nice, neat termination is almost vanishingly improbable. We've had a lot of experience since 2001 in what happens when you topple a government but don't stabilize the aftermath. You know, Afghanistan in 2001-2, Iraq in 2003, Libya in 2011. We've seen this movie before a lot. All that happens when you pull the government down is you inaugurate the next phase in the campaign. If you don't stabilize the population, if you don't provide some sort of governance model that can create enough voluntary buy-in from enough of the different factions in society that they're willing to adjudicate conflict without shooting at each other, all you get when you pull the flag down is insurgency and civil war and a change in the dramatis personae for the next phase.
And Andrew Exum, it seems to me that you fundamentally agree with what we just heard.
No, that's exactly right, and no surprise. I mean, I've Steve Biddle was one of my mentors and teachers, so I always make a habit of agreeing with what Steve says. But in this case, I think it's something that we've seen borne out, like Steve says, in practice in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that what we're seeing right now in Syria, meanwhile, is we are seeing all the parties, especially in northern Syria, the Turks, the Russians, the regime, and the Kurds, trying to game out what post-ISIL Syria looks like and how they can shape that state to their advantage. This is something that is common in civil wars. All parties to civil wars fight these conflicts with an eye towards what the post-conflict settlement looks like. And I think one of the things that's really worrying the Turks, and this is no, you know, blinding flash of the obvious for those familiar with the region, is that the Kurds in Syria are trying to carve out a statelet of their own, which the Turks see as a real threat to their long-term security.
Okay, former military people and current diplomats on our program. It's great to have Andrew Exum, Stephen Biddle, as well as Gordon Lubold with The Wall Street Journal. We're going to come back. We'll also talk with Laura Rosen with El Monitor about, once again, the situation regarding ISIS and President Trump. On our talking point later, a reclusive right-winger hopes to repeat Donald Trump's success in a traditionally liberal country, the Netherlands. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Trump has promised he would speed up the surrender of ISIS and the fall of the caliphate, as he refers to it, and others do as well. We've heard from two very distinguished former military and diplomatic officers. I want to go back to Gordon Lubold with the Wall Street Journal. We've heard that caution ought to be exercised here. How much pressure is President Trump getting? How much is he generating about speeding up the process and being able to show something so he can say that his promises have been realized?
I think he's probably under he's put himself under enormous pressure, because this is one of the things I think he walked in thinking this would be an easy to do. And I think it was to Andrew's point, you know, it's not necessarily as easy as he might have thought. So there will be that kind of conflict. If he does some of these things that I kind of mentioned, just like adding some more troops, maybe turning up the rate of airstrikes, of doing a few other kinds of things, and they're going to be a little hinky about talking about some of this stuff, but I think it will be to the Trump administration's benefit to kind of talk about the stuff they want to talk about, to kind of show that they're doing more. I think he will learn, I think, as early as tomorrow, kind of what the plan, the recommendations look like. But I think if he acts on some of them, there'll be some easy ones to kind of show to the American public that he's doing that, he's taking the fight, he's turning it up. The point I would also make, though, is that this was born of an executive order that came out January 28th. Mr. Trump said, "I need a plan in 30 days." This is not unexpected, but it's also not a long time to kind of come up with like a true, comprehensive, enduring strategy to fight these guys long after the physical caliphate disappears. And so I think that we're going to see kind of this is not the plan. This is the low-hanging fruit that they can kind of get to, show some headlines that they're doing more. But the kind of really heavier lifting is going to come kind of down the line over the next several months, where they look at how to kind of go more comprehensively after the Islamic State.
Gordon Lubold with the Wall Street Journal. Laura Rosen, as promised, is with us. She's correspondent for El Monitor. That's an online news outlet that focuses on the Middle East. Good to have you back with us, and
thanks for joining us.
What's already happening in the Middle East? What, for example, has the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff been doing? It's my understanding that he's gotten together with the Turks and the Kurds in such a way that he's concerned the Turks.
I think that there were photos of him visiting Kurdish forces in Syria over the weekend, and I think the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, McCain, also dropped into Syria briefly and met with the SDF forces.
SDF? What does that mean?
They're predominantly Kurdish Syrian defense forces that the U.S. special operators have been primarily working with to kind of put pressure around Raqqa and then the city they've taken in northern Syria called Manbij. And as previous guests were saying, causing some consternation from the Turks.
What about Russia?
Actually, just listening to your earlier guest, you know, talking about the importance of not just taking Raqqa and taking territory, but finding a way to try to stabilize these places afterwards. Russia is now in, among other things, is in Geneva, where there are these Syria talks underway, and the U.S. has sent a diplomat, the same one Obama had during the Obamacare time, Michael Ratney. But Syria is very impatient to talk with Trump about Syria and how to fight ISIS, and I think a long-term Syria stabilization plan. And unfortunately, Trump does not seem very oriented to the diplomatic, you know, community and the State Department at all. He seems to want to do everything through the generals, and this is the kind of, you know, really difficult task where you'd want to have, you know, senior diplomats talking with the Russians probably, and the UN and others about, you know, what's going to be the longer term way to stabilize Syria, where you have more than half the country under the control of Assad and some post-ISIS, mostly Sunni, rump state. Like, who, you know, how are they going to coexist? And it doesn't seem as yet that Trump appreciates that part of the government that he oversees now, to empower them and to get their talents and get them working on some of these hard problems that, you know, you hear all the generals saying they cannot solve on their own.
There have been so many reports about people having either been removed or leaving the State Department, removed from the State Department or leaving it. It's surprising to me that you say the same diplomat that President Obama had in the Geneva talks has been sent there by the Trump administration. Is that because there's nobody else left?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Ratney was a career diplomat, and not only is the Syria envoy, but I saw that in February he was made the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. So he'll be dual-hatted. That sort of seemed to go unannounced, and possibly is not something that they had to run up all the way to the top of the White House flagpole. I'm not sure. It seems like there is some problem. Tillerson can't even get his deputy approved by the White House to go through a nomination hearing. So, maybe over time, maybe in 4 or 6 months, people like McMaster and Tillerson will have been able to impress Trump with the importance of having that kind of skill set, basically, to try to solve, the problem of Syria.
Andrew Exum, are you surprised to hear that a former diplomat of the Obama administration now has an expanded role in this?
No, I think it's probably more less expanded than a continuation. The diplomat in question, Michael Ratney, I know well. He has been he's kind of the designated ambassador level outreach to the Syrian opposition groups. Michael's a foreign service officer, Arabic speaker, deeply experienced in the region. He's exactly who you would want to be doing this, and either even if the State Department was fully staffed. I think what Laura says is correct, though. At some point, you're going to get to this point where, and I, having spent a long time in 2006 across a conference table with Russian generals discussing Syria, I would question the utility of talks with Russia on Syria right now. But at some point, you're going to get to the point where you're thinking through, okay, what does post-conflict Syria look like? And you're going to want to have as many stakeholders in the room as possible. By the time you get to that point, one would hope that Secretary Tillerson will be fully staffed. As it is, he has a marvelous Foreign Service Officer Corps and one that that can provide him certainly the expertise and the continuity of relationships that he'll need to be successful in the interim.
Why is this a bad time to talk with the Russians?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First off, just from a pragmatic perspective, the Russians actually don't bring a ton to the table in Syria. They don't actually have a lot of combat forces on the ground. And I think it is it's questionable the degree to which they can bring along their coalition partners being the Iranians, being Hezbollah, and being the government in Damascus. We tried to test this to see if they could bring them along in 2006, and we never found an instance where, quite frankly, the Russians were really able to use their leverage over the regime. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that Russia is waging a very different type of campaign than we are in Syria. We've always said that, hey, if Russia wants to go after the Islamic State, we're there for them. We're happy to work with them to defeat the Islamic State. That's something that Secretary Carter said. That's something that Secretary Mattis has reiterated. But the fact is that the Russians have oriented the vast majority of their military efforts in Syria, not focused on the Nusra Front or on the Islamic State, but on the moderate Syrian opposition. And they're doing so in a way where the vast majority, over 90% of the weapons that fall off of Russian planes are, sometimes they do fall off rather than deliberately dropped, are unguided munitions. So if you get in bed with the Russians in Syria, you need to be, you need to know exactly what you're getting in bed with. You're getting in bed with arguably the least powerful member of that coalition in Syria, and you're getting along, you're getting involved with one that has aided and abetted the slaughter of tens of thousands of Syrian civilians through either malevolence or incompetence. So I would be very cautious about engaging too closely with the Russians at this stage in the campaign.
Laura Rosen, back to you with El Monitor. What about the other countries in the Middle East besides Syria and Iraq, some of whom are allied with the United States, or at least in a tentative kind of way, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, for example. We give them a lot of money. Where do they come down on all of this, and how do they feel about the Trump administration?
So I think the Egyptian President Sisi met with a Middle East Institute delegation a couple of weeks ago, and people on that trip said, you know, Sisi's just over the moon, you know, very excited, sees himself as kind of in the same type of leader as Trump, very strong, against terrorism, kind of pro-secular, and is very enthusiastic about working with him. I think I remember covering the beginning of the Obama administration, a lot of the same kind of honeymoon feeling from the Middle East. People were so excited to deal with Obama and not to be dealing with, you know, Bush, who invaded Iraq and caused all these problems. So I think there is a kind of maybe over-expectation or over-excitement that will, you know, will undoubtedly wear off for some allies, you know, when they confront the disappointments of working with the U.S. And you know, the dilemmas that caused friction with the U.S. under Obama are pretty much not unique to Obama's leadership. They are ones that will continue. So, you know, you've seen some countries like UAE seem pretty comfortable with Trump. I think Turkey's probably the honeymoon's going to end sooner than later. So we'll see.
And when you say there are frictions, describe briefly, if you will, what they are and why they're likely to continue.
Well, for instance, you know, the Saudis saw the Obama administration's approach to Iran as sort of a larger, the U.S. Letting Iran play a too strong role in the region, and for instance, in Iraq, as people were mentioning before, the Turks are frustrated that the U.S. tends to work with the Kurdish forces in Syria. Trump may not want to fix the Middle East and be as present in the Middle East and use military force to the degree that I think some of the allies would like him to. I think Trump talks tough, but he also talks about not wanting to get bogged down in the Middle East in another war. So, you know, part of their frustration is that they see the U.S. kind of not wanting to do as much military lift and, you know, protect them from their enemies within and without. And I think they may find that there's more continuity between Trump and Obama than they wished.
Stephen Biddle, back to you. You talked earlier about the importance of what happens after the fall of ISIS and the need to stabilize the population in Syria and particularly and in Iraq as well. Do you see any chance for cooperation with Russia in this regard?
Probably not very much. In large part because our interests and the Russians in this conflict align rather poorly. We are interested overwhelmingly in what happens to the Islamic State and secondarily in the general problem of terrorism against the West. The Russians' primary concern here is to preserve their ally Assad. As Andrew pointed out earlier, their efforts against the Islamic State have been tepid at best. And given that what they want and what we want don't align all that well, and given that they're not bringing that much to the table militarily, it's kind of hard to see how this cooperation works all that well, especially given that if you were serious about stabilizing the place, if you didn't simply want to inaugurate the next phase in the Syrian civil war afterwards, the bill for doing that is enormous. If you just take the standard rule of thumb in U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine for how many troops it takes to actually stabilize a populated area that's been subject to this kind of civil warfare and instability, and you apply that rule of thumb to the population of just the area that ISIL now controls, much less the rest of Syria, you get a bill somewhere between 50 and 100,000 capable outside counterinsurgents, most of whom would presumably have to be American. And the area the Islamic State controls isn't the only area we care about. If the Islamic State falls, the next militant group in line steps up. If you have to apply this problem to the entirety of the Syrian civil war, you're talking about 300,000 to 400,000 troops. Nobody is interested in that kind of investment. Not us, not the Russians, not the Turks.
Even if we made that kind of commitment, Would it, in fact, protect Americans from terrorism, either overseas or on American soil?
Well, there are many people these days who believe that stabilization is just impossible, that you simply can't do it regardless of the bill you pay. Now, I'm not in that camp. I tend to think that stabilization is very expensive, both in lives and in dollars. But if you make the investment, you can do it. I think the evidence from Afghanistan and Iraq suggests that if you make the investment, you can do it. The problem is the investment is way more expensive than anybody's willing to make. And if we're going to be realistic, actually, about what we're trying to accomplish and what we're going to get in exchange for whatever escalation we undertake in Syria, I think we need to understand what the cost of really doing the job right would be, which is, again, a lot higher than I think anyone is actually willing to pay.
And very quickly, Gordon Lubel, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. What about airspace and the fact that the Russians are, in fact, bombing, and so are we?
Yeah, so this is an issue that's kind of active under active discussion right now, which is the U.S. military has a very strong interest in making sure that there are no mishaps over Syria with the Russians in particular. And there's already what's called a memorandum of understanding that helps kind of, quote-unquote, on deconfliction. But what's under consideration now is not coordination or collaboration, but higher-level exchanges to make sure that, you know, with all the airspace being used by the Russians and by the U.S., that there are no accidents. And this is concerning to some, I think, even inside the Pentagon. But the uniform military is heavily in favor of kind of getting to some kind of agreement on that. And that's what General Dunford was talking about in Azerbaijan a week or so ago.
Okay. Presumably, as time goes on, we'll find out what the Pentagon is telling the new president and, of course, how he responds, what he decides to do. I want to thank you all for being with us. Gordon Lubel with The Wall Street Journal. Andrew Exum, who is associate editor at The Atlantic Magazine, formerly Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East Policy during the Obama administration. Stephen Biddle, political science professor, George Washington University, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, another person with experience in the Middle East. And Laura Rosen, correspondent for Al Monitor, news outlet focusing on that part of the world. Thank you all very much for being on our program. In a moment, a right-wing challenge to centuries of liberal tradition in the Netherlands. Back in a moment with today's talking point on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alney here with today's talking point. The Netherlands is traditionally one of Europe's most liberal countries, with centuries of welcoming immigrants and tolerating diverse religions. Now, a one-man political party who lives under police protection has deployed social media to become a strong candidate to be prime minister with a platform that will sound familiar to Americans. Here's a public statement by Geir Wilders.
We saw in the United States that despite all the rhetoric of the elite, Mr. Trump won the election. I hope I can repeat the same thing, because once again, the people want to be in charge again. It's not only America first, it's also Holland first, and that's what I try to accomplish.
Christopher Schutz contributes to the New York Times from his base in the Netherlands. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What comparisons can be made between Geert Wilders and Donald Trump?
I think there are some obvious comparisons. The big one is social media. It's the political rhetoric employed. There are also some pretty stark differences, and the main one being that Geert Wilders has been around for ages. He's the third longest-serving parliamentarian here in the Netherlands.
He's been there for a long time. How has he suddenly become so important?
I think that he's become so important mostly because we're now looking at this year of populist or possible populist elections in Europe, and the Netherlands is sort of seen as the bellwether state, if you will. I think that he has been around for a while. He's actually been quite popular. In 2010, he supported the government, the minority government, so he actually has sort of been in power. But this year, we're really looking at the entirety of Europe after Brexit, after Trump, with three big elections that could actually probably end the EU, because there are these in the Netherlands, he's talking about questioning membership to the European Union.
Okay, so the election in the Netherlands comes up on March 15th, as I understand it. In the meantime, how has he, with 19 years in the parliament, been able to cultivate an outsider image?
He's extremely shrewd. I think he's a brilliant politician, a brilliant tactician. He makes sure that he's not seen as part of the establishment by swearing in parliament, by not showing respect to other parliamentarians, by calling parliament fake. He is very good at tweeting sort of outrageous and seemingly sort of outsider things. And he has been under constant high-level police protection for the last 14 years, so that we really don't see him out and about in the Netherlands. He sleeps supposedly in a different house every night. I don't think that's true, but he's sort of under guard, so he's left to really control his own image.
Apparently his organization, his party, consists only of him. Who else does he represent?
I mean, it's tricky because he does have the organization, the PVV, has currently, I think, 15 members in parliament. His party it's more a technicality, I think, that he's the only member of the party, and that gives him total control. But there are, of course, other parliamentarians, and you'll see people voting for the party, not for him. But he's actually legally the only member, so he's in control of the message. He's in control of finances.
I understand that in addition to his conservative ideas and the idea of the Netherlands first, he is socially liberal.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not he really is socially liberal, we don't know. But we do know that he, in pursuit of power and popularity, he has become socially liberal. And in the Netherlands, it seems that even if you sort of follow some extreme, what people would call extreme right-wing ideology on, let's say, immigrants, or rhetoric, let's say, on immigrants and Muslims and so forth, and you still have to have sort of a social bent to be popular. And one big thing is social security, but also sort of progressive issues like gay marriage and so forth.
So he supports all of those things. Well, what does he have to say, particularly about immigration and about Muslims as well?
I mean, a lot of it is shock language. He's now called for banning the Quran, calling it the equivalent of Hitler's Mein Kampf. He's called for closing mosques. So a lot of it is sort of designed to shock. And this rhetoric actually has become more and more extreme over the years. 5 years ago, he just said, okay, no new mosques. Now he's saying they should be closed. It's sort of designed to get a reaction, I think, from the voters.
When you say that he's under police protection and lives under police protection and may, in fact, sleep in different houses, although you were dubious about whether he did that every night, nonetheless, who's he hiding from and where are the threats coming from?
I mean, there are apparently credible death threats from Islamic extremists. There are two big high-profile assassinations in the early noughts. 2002, his sort of forefather, Pim Fortuyn, was killed, and in 2004, Theo van Gogh was killed, and both sort of were killed for their strong right-wing beliefs, although not both by extremist Muslims. So everyone you speak with actually says that he probably does have good reason to be under police protection.
Elaborate a little bit, if you will, on the election itself and how it relates to the rest of Europe and the future of the European Union.
Well, he's called for at least a questioning of whether or not Nexit, the exit of the Netherlands, should happen. He is currently polling at he would currently get about the most seats in Parliament. But the thing is that is still there are 12 parties in Parliament, and that still doesn't assure him government or indeed leadership in any kind of coalition government, especially because the other parties, most of them have said, we won't work with this guy. So it might actually happen that he gets the most votes, but that he actually can't form a government. And so it's more of a black eye, if you will, and not really a change in power dynamics in The Hague.
So he's unlikely then to be part of a coalition government.
That's what all the main parties are saying, in particular the center-right sort of conservative, mainstream conservative party, and they were the ones that actually were in a coalition government or were supported by his party some 7 years ago. But the Dutch tend to say that, you know, they're saying this now before the election, but let's see what happens after the votes are in and after they're forced to form some kind of a government. There are many experts that say that possibly he could be in a coalition government.
How much stress, how much tension is there in the Netherlands, a place we often think of as being peaceful and where people are well-adjusted to one another?
I would actually say this is what is so interesting about this election and about this man's popularity. The Netherlands is really much like you would imagine it. I mean, it is pretty peaceful. It has low unemployment. It's certainly not as troubled as other places, and they've also not let in a huge number of refugees recently. I mean, a good number, but not let's say like Germany. That's sort of the thing that is curious about this, is okay. That the Netherlands is not doing them so badly.
Well, thank you for telling us about Geert Wilders. Again, Christopher Schutz is a journalist based in the Netherlands, contributor to the New York Times. Great to have you on our program, and many thanks.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.